From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama says U.S. counterterrorism pressure in Yemen continues. An American Muslim analyst's view of freedom of speech.
What those criminals did were not acts of Islam.
Strategies for countering Islamic radicalism. And the hostage crisis could divide Japan over plans to boost its role in global security. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. President Barack Obama says U.S. counterterrorism operations in Yemen continue despite last week's resignation of President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi amid pressure from Shiite Houthi militiamen who overran the presidential palace. VOA's Victor Beatty reports two U.S. lawmakers Sunday suggested more U.S. special operations troops may be needed in countries battling extremists.
During a Sunday joint news briefing with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi in New Delhi, Mr. Obama discounted media reports that U.S. counterterrorism operations aimed primarily at al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP, had been curtailed in Yemen.
I saw some news reports that suggested somehow that counterterrorism activity had been suspended. That is not accurate. We continue to go after high-value targets inside of Yemen, and we will continue to maintain the pressure that's required to keep the American people safe.
The president says the United States will continue to pursue a strategy of partnering and sharing intelligence with governments in Yemen and Iraq rather than resort to what he calls a massive U.S. military deployment in perpetuity. He says that is an unsustainable strategy and would create more problems than it would solve. Appearing Sunday on the CBS program Face the Nation, Mr. Obama's chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, says the administration was not surprised by Thursday's resignation of Yemen's president.
We knew that this was an ongoing challenge over the course of the last several months. That's why we've been pressing on all the actors to take important steps to address the situation. We're continuing to do that today.
McDonough says governance in Yemen has always been difficult. He says the United States will continue to press the actors on the ground to make decisions transparently pursuant to a political agreement to remain on the offense against AQAP, which hides in what he calls these dark, tumultuous situations to ply their trade. Appearing on the same program, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, John McCain, says the president and his White House chief of staff have lost touch with reality in pursuing their Mideast policy.
Iran is on the march throughout. In Yemen, it's not AQAP that's taken over the government. It's the Houthis who, guess what, are backed and supported by the Iranians. The Iranians are now either dominant or extremely influential in Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen. They're on the move in Bahrain, and they are winning.
McCain says there is no strategy to effectively counter terrorists in the region, and it is time for more U.S. forces on the ground.
It means forward air controllers, it means special forces, it means intelligence, and it means other capabilities. And for them to say, we expect them to do it on their own, they're not doing it on their own, and they're losing.
Also appearing on U.S. television, the ranking Democrat on the Senate's Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, says the future of Yemen remains unknown.
The Houthis have said they would leave us alone, and yet their slogan is death to America, death to Israel. They have deposed the president. The military has separated off. We have less than 300 Yemeni military guarding our embassy. So I think there are a number of priorities there. One is to see that our people are safe. The second is to take a good look at our policy with respect to Yemen.
Feinstein also says more U.S. special forces will be needed with a mission that goes beyond merely advising troops in the host country. RAND Corporation senior political scientist and former Army officer Rick Brennan warns U.S. foreign policy is now in crisis, failing to adequately address what he calls the Sunni-Shia civil war in the Middle East.
There is no consistent effort on the part of this government in terms of how we're going to go about addressing this issue. And on one hand, you've got al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations. And the other, you have Iran and what Iran is doing to sponsor unrest throughout the region. And the Houthi is just one example of the types of organizations that is training, organizing, funding. And while they say they're not involved in doing that, all the markers are there, just as they were in providing support to the Shia militia groups in Iraq as well as the Assad regime in Syria.
Brennan agrees there needs to be more U.S. special forces in the region and a more robust intelligence-gathering effort that comes from capturing terror suspects. He says the 23 drone strikes against AQAP in Yemen over each of the past 2 years represents a minuscule response to what the group is doing. Brennan warns we are entering a more dangerous period in the Middle East than at any time in his life. The UN Security Council is to hold a closed-door meeting Monday on the Yemen crisis. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
This month's terror attack on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in France was a violent extremist challenge to values of freedom of expression. It also has set fire to anti-Muslim sentiment. Hoda El-Shatawi with the Muslim Public Affairs Council has written an article titled Uniting Against Violent Extremism and for Freedom of Expression. We asked how she perceives freedom of speech and freedom of the news media.
I believe, just like every other American and really every other Muslim within our faith, that teaches us that freedom of expression and freedom of speech is an absolute right that should be upheld. Certainly there are cases like what we saw in Paris and with the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, where people exercise that speech and it may be used for, satirical purposes and people may take offense to it. But at the same time, we can't respond to something that we deem offensive with violence. So absolutely, we as Muslims uphold the right to free expression and free speech.
What does the Muslim community need to do to rein in violent behavior like what we saw in France?
Well, really, it is up to Muslims to take on that leadership role to confront and combat violent extremism. But what we saw in France really had nothing to do with Islam, as in what those criminals did were not acts of Islam. There in no way is any justification within the faith that would allow for them to react in that way. And in fact, in the Quran, there are several examples of people who used to call the Prophet himself a soothsayer or a magician or a madman, and he would respond by taking that conversation to the marketplace of ideas, and they would have a discussion and have a conversation. He never once responded in violence, and there are no justifications or examples of the Prophet ever responding in violence.
Do Muslim clerics need to step forward?
Absolutely. Like I said, this is, in addition to governments taking responsibility and ensuring that people are united and communities are not marginalized, and at the same time that media and journalists are reporting with responsibility and they're being responsible journalists, we do look upon Muslim communities, Muslim governments, Muslim leaders to take on that leadership role to really have these deep discussions about what does it mean to be a Muslim? What does it mean to live in democratic societies? What does it mean to uphold these freedoms and principles and values?
Specifically, what can governments do to not have divisions within these communities, to have everybody welcomed?
Sure. I think as a result of what we saw in Paris, we did see a lot of leaders take on some really great positive roles. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, saying that Muslims are part of the community. We shouldn't marginalize the Muslim community. Really ensuring that there are policies that help create an environment of nationalism for everyone, so that there are policies when people immigrate to countries and they take on a new home country, they're able to integrate well. So we're really looking for governments and these leaders to ensure that there is unity among the people.
Do you feel that non-Muslims don't feel welcome within the Muslim community?
I'm not sure that is necessarily the case. And what we see here, especially in America, is that American Muslims have integrated really well, and there are various polls, whether from Gallup or Pew Research, that they've shown that American Muslims have been really integrated into society. We have higher levels of education. We have high levels of income. So I think the story of America really is very unique because we are a nation of immigrants, So that idea and upholding those values of being an American and it's okay to be unique and different really allows for all Americans, whatever background, ethnicity, race, or creed, to enjoy the idea of being an American.
Hoda El-Shatawi, National Policy Analyst with the Muslim Public Affairs Council. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in London last week called the campaign against the group known as the Islamic State the challenge of our times. Addressing the 21-nation coalition formed to fight ISIS militants, Kerry said the effort would involve police and intelligence agencies around the world flushing out supporters and sleeper cells. London meeting focused on what can be done to cut off the organization's funding, stop the spread of its propaganda, and stem the flow of foreign fighters to its ranks. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Washington-based Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, about strategies being considered for countering the rising tide of Islamic radicalism and terrorism.
The terrorists who are abusing Islam claim that Islam's major enemy is the West. How can Muslim leaders in the West counter this claim?
This is a very wrong and oversimplified assumption. We don't agree with many of the policies of the West, and we need to have dialogue with the West, with Europe and with the United States. We need to explain to them not only our faith, but also our grievances. We need to explain to them what is wrong with their current policies in the Arab world, in the Muslim world. They are committing a lot of mistakes, but to oversimplify and say that they are the enemies of Islam is completely false and wrong. And we have to move away from this polarization. Islam is a universal religion. It's everywhere, including in the West. The West and the East now are interconnected much more than ever. Muslims do not live on an island. We're not isolated from the world. We must engage the West in a dialogue, and we must build trust and build confidence on both sides so that we become allies and that we protect our interests. They protect their interests through peaceful means and through dialogue. There are a lot of wrong policies that must be changed, but I think they are best addressed and changed through dialogue.
So what are the real roots of radicalism that cause some young Muslims to join radical or terrorist organizations?
There are many root causes. One of the main ones, I think, is the lack of freedom, the lack of dignity, the lack of democracy in many Arab countries and Muslim countries, which for the last 50 or 60 years, this is not something new. But the result of this corruption and the result of this oppression is that many young people have given up on hope and on peaceful change. They don't see the benefit. They don't believe that peaceful democratic change is possible, because they see these authoritarian regimes as holding on to power with the support of the West and refusing democracy or refusing to give rights and freedom to the people. So they resort to violence. And I think the best solution, one of the most important solutions, is for the West to promote democracy and to stop supporting these tyrannical regimes, these oppressive regimes that I think are the main cause of the rise of violence and radicalism and terrorism.
You called for a new modern interpretation of Islam that can help counter terrorism. If Islamic teachings do not call for violence, how would your call benefit the cause of countering terrorism?
Because we have to educate people, especially young people, on the true values of Islam. There is a lot of young people out there in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, again, as a result of the oppression and corruption and dictatorships, that are very poorly educated about Islam. So they are very vulnerable. When they hear these messages of extremism, they think that is Islam. They think that is Islam teaches violence and terrorism. So it is very important that we explain to them the true Islam. And also, there are dangerous interpretations of Islam, maybe that do not call to violence, but call to rejection of modernity, rejection of the 21st century, such as Salafism and Wahhabism. They may not be violent, but they put the Muslim in a dilemma, the Muslim, especially young Muslim, as if he has to choose between being Muslim and being modern or living in the modern age. And this choice creates very, very difficult dilemmas for young people. Most of them say, okay, no, I'm going to reject modernity and choose Islam. So we have to show them that you don't have to choose. that you can be Muslim and modern at the same time. And that is why we need a modern interpretation of Islam. This is not something new. As Muslim, we believe that Islam is valid for all times and all places because it has the flexibility to adapt to the changing needs and conditions of the society. You cannot take an interpretation of a scholar with our utmost respect for the scholar from 1,000 years ago and apply it today as if his interpretation is eternal. No, it is not, because the conditions have changed and the priorities and the nature of the society has changed. So we need a new modern interpretation and jurisprudence for the 21st century.
Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Washington-based Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. The Islamic State Group's apparent beheading of one Japanese hostage and its threat to kill a second are stark reminders to Tokyo that its increasing diplomatic profile and close friendship with the United States could make it a target for terrorists. VOA's Bryden Padden reports the hostage crisis could further polarize Japanese opinion over Tokyo's plan to play a more active role in global security.
Japanese Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga said Monday the government is working closely with the Jordanian government to secure the release of remaining Japanese hostage Kenji Goto. Suga says human life remains the Japanese government's priority, so from that perspective, they are working closely with the Jordanian government, related tribal chiefs and religious leaders and other such organizations. He also said Japan has not had direct contact with the Islamic State militant group. Islamic State militants who are holding war correspondent Kenji Goto claim to have beheaded a second hostage, self-employed security contractor Haruna Yukawa. The group had set a $200 million ransom for release of the two men and set a 72-hour deadline for payment that expired Friday. In a video posted online Sunday, a voice that is purportedly Goto's says the militants have dropped their ransom demand and will free him in exchange for the release of Sajida Arisawi, an Iraqi held in Jordan.
So you don't need to worry about funding terrorists. They are just demanding the release of their imprisoned sister, Sajida Arisawi. It is simple.
Arisawi was arrested in 2005 for attempting to blow herself up in one of three deadly hotel bombings in Amman. The hostage crisis comes at a time when Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is trying to play a more active role in global security. The $200 million ransom demand made by the militants was the same amount Prime Minister Abe pledged in non-military aid for refugees displaced by the rise of the Islamic State, which holds large parts of Iraq and Syria. Mr. Abe is also trying to change Japan's pacifist constitution to allow the military to act more proactively to protect the lives of its citizens and defend the nation and its allies. His proactive pacifism plan has been controversial in Japan and in the region due to the country's past wartime aggression. Koichi Nakano, a professor of political science at Sophia University in Tokyo, says the hostage crisis will likely further polarize the public.
On the one hand, the government would make the argument that this is the reason why we need the government to be more proactive in taking part in the war on terror. But a large number of the Japanese remain unconvinced that that's actually the case.
Professor Nakano says underneath Mr. Abe's strong support in the polls in the midst of this hostage crisis, there is also concern that he is exposing Japan to greater risk by taking a more high-profile military and diplomatic role. Bryden Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 26, 1564, the Pope issued a bull or charter confirming decisions made by the Council of Trent, which clarified Roman Catholic doctrine and condemned Protestantism. On this day in 1788, British Captain Arthur Phillip, commanding a fleet of 11 ships carrying some 700 convicts, established the first European settlement in New South Wales. The anniversary is a national holiday in Australia. In 1880, American General Douglas MacArthur was born. MacArthur fought in three major wars and rose to the rank of five-star general in the U.S. Army. He oversaw the surrender of Japan at the end of World War II and presided over its occupation. He was relieved of his duties when he openly questioned President Truman's policies. In 1924, the city of Petrograd in the Soviet Union was renamed Leningrad after the founder of communism. In 1991, there was another change when the city reverted to its historic name, St. Petersburg. On this day in 1950, the Indian Constitution took effect, making India the most populous democracy in the world. In 1998, U.S. President Bill Clinton looked into a TV camera and denied having had sexual relations with former White House intern Monica Lewinsky. He later admitted that he had indeed had an affair with a young woman. Mr. Clinton eventually faced impeachment by Congress stemming from his relationship with Lewinsky. In 2004, Afghan President Hamid Karzai signed a new constitution for his country. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is redoubling its efforts to advance the New Silk Road Initiative, which economically links Afghanistan with Central and South Asia. The region, said U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asian Affairs, Fatima Sumar, has enormous barriers preventing the movement of peoples, goods, energy, and ideas. The United States sees an opportunity for people across this region to have a better future. It is in the economic interest of these states to have stable neighbors, where economic conditions are enhanced by economic diversification. And this is exactly what the United States is supporting through the New Silk Road Initiative, which focuses on four areas: creating a regional energy market, facilitating trade and transit, streamlining customs and borders, and connecting people and businesses. The United States believes the new north-south trade routes across Central and South Asia can ultimately complement important east-west routes that tie Europe and East Asia. With regard to energy markets in Central Asia, there is tremendous opportunity to further develop capacity and seek new markets for export. Several Central Asian countries have already found a market for their electricity in Afghanistan. Recently, the World Bank's CASA 1000 project, which aims to bring surplus summer power from Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan to Afghanistan and Pakistan, reached another important milestone with the signing of the Transit Price Agreement between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Action on the development of the Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-India, or TAPI, natural gas pipeline, can provide additional markets for Turkmen natural gas in South Asia, where the demand for natural gas is critical. In addition, Afghanistan stands to benefit from transit revenue and jobs as it continues to strengthen its economy. Unlike other regional energy projects, TAPI can only be financed by the private sector and not the donor community. Therefore, it is critically important to identify an international oil company that is willing to lead the TAPI consortium and help bring the project to fruition. The U.S. believes the Silk Road Initiative is the best way to bring about a stable, secure, and prosperous future for South and Central Asia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.